right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Philip Drew, Administrator. This is Radio Chaos 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas, and chaos959.com, streaming live worldwide. And our next guest is Bill Kelsey. You may remember I interviewed him last summer. He was raised in Jordan. He's a fluent Arabic speaker, flies relief missions for a living, and including into Iraq last year, where he got to witness what was going on there, I suppose right about 1 year ago, somewhere around there, right after the fall of the regime. And we all know that there's a lot of news about the American occupation of Iraq this week, and I thought that it would be good to get somebody on who's been there and who can tell us from at least a little bit of first-hand experience about what Iraq is like and whether he can help us make any sense of what's going on there. So welcome back to the show, Mr. Kelsey.
Well, thank you very much.
It seems like all hell is breaking loose in Iraq right now. The Sunnis have been giving us trouble up in the what they call the Sunni Triangle pretty much all along, while the Shia have been mostly biding their time and hoping that their majority numbers will give them control of the wonderful democracy we create over there. And so, basically to hold off. And it seems al-Sistani has been the leader of the Shia over there and the more moderate. But now, a new mullah of the Shiites has come to power, or has risen, named al-Sadr. And apparently at least some number of Shiites are following him in basically declaring open warfare against the occupation forces. So I'm wondering if you can help explain to us a little bit about who al-Sadr is and who al-Sistani are and the relationship between them and what's really going on down there in Shia land in southern Iraq.
Yeah. Well, first thing I'd like to do is acknowledge one prediction of mine that was slightly off, and then on the other hand, give credit to our president where credit is due. I had been predicting that the Shia were standing by the sidelines waiting for the Americans and the remnants, diehards, or whatever you call them, to simply exhaust themselves and the Wahhabis. There is a deep antagonism between the Wahhabis, which is a subset of the Sunnis, the most Puritan forms, and they believe the extreme forms of Shia are complete blasphemy. Now, there's hostility between those, and I had always assumed there would be, as so many other people assume, there'd be civil war, and that maybe the Shia were just waiting for the Americans and the Wahhabis and Ba'athists to exhaust each other, and then the Shia would be in a position to move into dominance. But I was wrong. They're not. They're you know, this is across the spectrum, and they're making a great point of saying that. Who knows how long it'll last? So to give our president due, he's managed to unite. He's a uniter. He's united the Iraqis. It's quite a feat. They've never been so united for a long time.
And, wow. Yeah, that sure is to his credit, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't think that was his intention, but anyway, he accomplished it, or he didn't intend to unite them in the way that they are united. And it looks like the number of people. I just don't see any demonstrations supporting the Americans. I don't see any signs of large units of Iraqis that are helping out the Americans. I do see the puppets, and this is a real sign of the time, is when your own puppets cease to dance to your strings. The strings seem to be breaking, and they're resigning from the governing council and are distancing themselves. And even the head of the governing council, Pachachi, who is the most respected person on the council from the Iraqi point of view, has gone on Al Jazeera and denounced the occupation.
Well, and the guy that resigned was the leader of the interior ministry that's in charge of the police and the army, right?
Right, right. That's what interior ministry is. It's not wildlife and gazelles. It's the secret police and the security agencies. That's what Ministry of Interior is in the Arab world. You're asking about these gentlemen's names. It gets a little bit complicated. Sistani does not appear in public, and he's a respected scholar, and he says something and sends a word out. One theory as to why he doesn't appear in public and why he doesn't speak that I read in various internet cruisings at some blogs out of Iraq is that he actually speaks with an Iranian accent. There's a lot of, among certain religious Shia, the scholars, there's a lot of travel back and forth between Iraq and Iran and even southern Lebanon, and there are a lot of families that sort of belong to two countries, and you can't really pinpoint, you can make a case that they're either Iranian or Iraqi or southern Lebanese for that matter, and they might have started out in southern Lebanon and then studied for two or three generations in Iran and then gone back to Lebanon or to Iraq. But anyway, so Sistani speaks with an Iranian accent, so his detractors are making the case that he's Iranian, and more significant is where everybody's getting their money from. Sadr is the son of a respected cleric, and he has no clerical standing on his own. And he was considered an upstart by many of the other Shia people in Iraq, but he has been given tremendous credibility. I mean, if the United States wants to promote a leader in Iraq, the best way to promote him is to declare him an outlaw. That gave him tremendous stature. If they want to destroy somebody in Iraq, probably the best way they could do it would be to invite him to have dinner with Paul Bremer and announce that this is a great Iraqi, and that would finish that person's career in Iraq.
Yeah, but TV was telling me as recent as a month ago how grateful the Iraqi people are that we're there.
Who was saying this?
TV.
Oh, yeah. Well, it could be, you know.
I think they were, now that I think about it, it was Fox News, but they were referring to a poll done by the BBC where they said that there were majorities of the Iraqi people said that they were much better off than they were before, and that they were glad we were there.
Well, some people do feel that way, and it's more complicated than that. I mean, let's say a snake had killed Saddam Hussein. People would be glad that the snake killed Saddam Hussein, but that doesn't mean they're going to fall in love with the snake. So
interesting analogy.
We have to understand that just because they really did hate Saddam Hussein a lot, and they would be glad if if he died in an earthquake, they'd be happy. Doesn't mean they appreciate the earthquake. And we've seen this before in World War II. There were people chafing under the Soviets who welcomed the Nazis, and that lasted about 2 weeks before they realized the Nazis were nasty, too. There were people chafing under the Nazis who welcomed the Soviets as liberators, and then didn't take them long to find out that the Soviets weren't that good. So just because they were grateful, some people were grateful that the United States came in, didn't mean that this gratitude could last forever. I'd also like to follow through on that and say that people who welcome the United States to Iraq can gradually become turn against the United States after a series of abuses and offenses and so forth. But once you're alienated, it's not really possible to get them back onto the American side. It's like milk. Once the milk has gone sour, you cannot make it unsour. And so to the extent that allies have turned against the United States or people who are neutral have turned against the United States, that's plausible and that's predictable. The other way around, it's equally predictable that you are not going to get people who are hostile to the United States to change their mind at this point until the Americans withdraw and until some enlightened leadership comes out of the United States that issues an apology to the Iraqi people for all that we've done to them.
Wow. Well, now that this uprising has broken out in the South, do you know whether al-Sistani has, what his comments have been about the revolt surrounding al-Sadr? I suppose if he's saying, all right, everybody be cool, then, you know, maybe they will wait till June 30th and then hope we just turn over sovereignty and run as fast as we can? Or is he endorsing the actions of al-Sadr?
No, he came out with a statement, and I'll give some names of people to who folks can look up on their blogs. Juan Cole is probably the most knowledgeable. If people just remember Juan Cole, just do a Google search, and he has a wonderful blog. He's got very enlightened and studied on Iraq and knows the intricacies of Shia politics and theology and religion. He's a professor up north somewhere. That's Juan, J-U-A-N-C-O-L-E. I don't know exactly what his blog is titled, but type that in and you'll find him. He has some pretty good stuff. It appears that Sistani came out with a statement which he condemned. He protected himself by condemning both the American reaction and behavior of the Americans, and then he condemned the lawlessness. I mean, whenever order breaks down, there are people who are less principled who just go out and loot. I mean, some will express their rebellion by looting. That happens. And apparently even Muqtada al-Sadr had to come out and say, we regret that people have taken advantage of this situation to misbehave and loot, and that's not part of us. The kidnapping of the Japanese apparently was one renegade group that Muqtada al-Sadr disassociated himself from, and the latest news is they're going to be released at the request of a committee of, or the Higher Islamic Council or something. There was this interesting story on the World on NPR last night. A London Times reporter by the name of Farrell was captured by a group of gunmen, and then another group of gunmen ran the first group off and captured him and said, those guys are just those are just bandits. They have no right to capture you. We do. We're the real Sadr people. We have a right. We're okay. And if you all are American soldiers, will be executing you if you can prove to us that you're reporters, we'll let you do a story on us. And fortunately, he was able to prove that he was a reporter and got out with his with all his property back. Actually, they made sure they got all the stuff back from the bandits. And so yeah, there are a lot of people acting freelance. So it could be that Sadr doesn't even have the ability to control this. I mean,
how widespread is it now, the rebellion? Or do we have,
I don't know. I'd love to get reports to see. I mean, what parts of the country are quiet? Are there any parts of the country where people are still? Well, I know Kurdistan there, that the Kurds do not want to be rebelling against the United States. But even people who are not rebelling are also. It doesn't mean they're pro-American. Yeah,
right.
You don't see large numbers of people volunteering to help the Americans out.
Well, and as you said at the beginning here, that this has now created solidarity, unprecedented solidarity between the Sunnis and the Shia in the name of Iraqi nationalism, where now the Shia are loading up pickup trucks with food and water and taking them up to Fallujah to help the Sunnis in their battle.
I mean, one positive outcome of all this is that the break of Iraq may not happen after all, because the United States has managed to annoy people. Here's what happens, and I don't think it's unique to Iraqi culture. The things that the American soldiers have to do, or perceive that they have to do in order to protect themselves, protect them in the short run, but offend enough people that they set themselves up to get shot at in the long run. So the way the soldiers behave at roadblocks, the way they humiliate people, they need to break into houses to maybe capture somebody. They don't want to unlock doors because maybe if we stick a key in a door and unlock the door, there's a booby trap. So let's bang the door down or stand far away from the door and shoot the lock off. And for the Iraqis who have not rigged up the lock with a booby trap, that's offensive. The soldiers are in a no-win situation. Either they risk their lives, or if they protect themselves in the short run, they set up their friends to get shot at later on. So there are just too many cases of people reading blogs from Iraq. There are just too many cases of people who were actually friendly to the Americans, but just had to encounter such rude behavior from so many soldiers. And then the rumor spreads around. People hear about it, and now a lot of them want revenge.
It sort of sounds like a brown recluse bite. It kind of, you know, as the toxin rots your flesh, it creates more toxin to rot more flesh, and it kind of makes its own poison as it progresses.
Yeah, and I talked about revenge, and some people like to point at Iraqis and try to analyze them as though they're extremely some strange exotic behavior, and I was even prepared to do that and say, well, you got to understand where revenge fits in into the Iraqi culture. And lo and behold, the Austin Statesman talked about on April 2nd in their editorial, well, we need to retaliate against the, we cannot let this go unpunished. We need retribution for the mutilation of the four bodies in Fallujah. Well, hey, when did, that's an interesting concept, retaliate for mutilation of bodies. Well, 1991, a stray smart bomb, a smart bomb must have become unsmart and landed in a marketplace in Fallujah and killed 100 people. And bombs mutilate bodies and burn them. So I wonder how many young children in 1991 who saw these charred and mangled corpses were jumping on the corpses of the four mercenaries last week. And then let's also remember, the question is, of course, is revenge a privilege only for Iraqis? Is it a quirk only for Iraqis, or is it something for just Americans who are entitled to retaliate? So the first massacre in by the Americans in Iraq was in Fallujah. And while discussing this, I'd like to give credit to the American colonel who came into Najaf. He was met by a mob, and he was very smart, and he told his men to get down on their knee and point their guns at the ground, and he walked forward unarmed and went up to the leaders of the mob, and they had a truce, and he defused the situation. It could have been bloody on both sides. The commander in Fallujah, faced with the same situation, had his men open fire. Some sergeant did anyway, and these guys panicked, killed 17 Iraqis. They tried to say that, they're returning fire from the Iraqi mob, but they didn't have any rifles caught and captured. And so there were 17 Iraqis killed and minor miscellaneous numbers subsequent to that. And then when the Marines took over from the Army a few weeks ago, they decided that they had a responsibility to go into Fallujah and show the people of Fallujah who was boss. And they kicked ass and busted down a bunch of doors and blew up a few houses and started a battle and killed a bunch of civilians who may have been in the crossfire. I mean, we can point fingers any way you want and say, well, it was the fault of the people who fired from a close proximity to civilians. But long and the short of it, civilians were killed in Fallujah. So these four guys, if you believe in the concept of retaliation, which I don't, it's what one piece of residual Christianity I have left in me. I think it's a backward practice. But people, unfortunately, believe in it, and it's not far-fetched that people in Fallujah had enough, and people went nutty and mutilated the bodies. And now we have our side, I say our side, the Washington regime side, had to go back into Fallujah. And what's the score now? About 400 people are on their side, of the Iraqi side, and 40-odd on our side.
Yeah, and then you flip through the AM dial, and all you hear is what we need to do is just go in there and drop one of them Moab bombs. Couple of them, that'll teach them Fallujans.
Right. And then they're going to wake up and say, well, let's all quit retaliating. Let's all turn into Francis of Assisi and Mother Teresa and the Dalai Lama.
Right. Well, they say the only thing these people understand is force. And I say, well, that's what they say about us.
Yeah.
That's why they crash their planes into our buildings, is because they say, you know, the Americans only understand one thing, force.
Yeah, usually the people use that figure of speech are guilty of that themselves. Actually, nobody understands force, because force can make you become very unwise when faced with the trauma of violence.
Okay, now you mentioned earlier about Al-Sistani and how he's got an Iranian accent, that the Shia population between Iraq and Iran is all sort of intermixed and educated together and that kind of thing. And I've noticed there were some things, in fact, Jim Loeb wrote a great column where he cites the Washington Times, the New York Times, and the LA Times all have, and maybe more than that, all have leaks from anonymous Pentagon sources say that Iran is behind the Shia uprising in the South. And the neoconservative ex-communists, now right-wingers, how they just can't wait to blame all this on Iran and go in there and have been encouraging George Bush to either do airstrikes or give them solemn warnings that they're next if they don't stop.
You know, I don't know. Do they? I read a report that the Mahdi, the army of the Mahdi, which is Muqtada al-Sadr's militia. I've read reports that they do get paid in dollars. I mean, that was one person's accusation, an Iraqi person who said they get money from Iran and they're paid salaries in dollars. But let's say it is Iran. Are we in a position to point a finger? I mean, who's an outsider here, a country from next door that shares a common religion with people, or is it somebody from across the ocean? I mean, who's really doing the most interference here? I have no idea to what extent. And then when we talk about Iran, are we talking about the Iranian government? Are we talking factions of the Iranian government? Are we talking about?
Now you're being way too careful. The neocons don't like distinctions like that. Let's just say an Iranian gave some money to a Shia somewhere in Iraq, and that's good enough.
Yeah.
We don't want all these detailed questions about whether the government was doing it as a matter of policy.
Yeah, if they take up a collection at the seminary in Qom for their brothers at the seminary in Najaf, what is that, and how much of that money goes for food, and then if it goes for food, how much of that is for fighters and how much is for widows, and we need to how much goes for guns, we don't know. But at the end of the day, it's probably irrelevant whether they've gotten a little bit of you can't really bribe people to mount a rebellion. You've seen the pictures and you've heard the stories. This there is a lot of spontaneity, even if there is some Iranian intelligence involvement. Probably, I'll tell you the truth. What I am assuming is that there is a vacuum where every ideological and religious movement in the world, in the Islamic world and even outside Korean missionaries, Korean fundamentalist Christian, they could even be Moonies for all I know, but the Koreans that were captured and released were missionaries. This is a place, right? If you have something you believe real strongly in and you want to change people's minds about it and you want a little test tube, a nice laboratory where change is happening in the world, well, where do you go but besides Iraq? This was the case in Lebanon that the Lebanese complained about. They said every single political and religious philosophy in the Arab world is acting out its conflicts in Lebanon. And you had that in the mid-70s going on for a long time. And that's happening in Iraq now. So, yeah, you ask if Iran, and probably more than one Iranian movement is involved in Iraq. There are Kuwaitis involved in Iraq. Saudis, the Wahhabis are sending money to their fellow people, fundamentalist Christians in America, are looking for evangelical Christians in Iraq to support with money and whatnot. That's to be expected.
Still not
now.
A casus belli for war against Iran, no matter what.
Oh, no. And actually, I'm not too concerned about that on a really perverse level. And this is this just shows how perverse it all is. If things had gone nicely, and if people had said, "Okay, America, you got rid of Saddam Hussein. Thank you very much. We'll all behave ourselves. We will not loot. We will not shoot each other. We will not shoot you. We'll set up a nice democratic government. We will not accuse you of." And the American soldiers themselves had been very polite, and the United States became unobtrusive, withdrew from the cities, and kept themselves to bases outside, and it all went out. And people, the only time Americans came into Baghdad, people scattered rose petals under their feet. You know, imagine the fun scenario. Let's say that happened, and there'd be lots of more people alive in Iraq, and it went real well in Iraq. Well, these crazy neocons would have us in war in Syria, and Iran and North Korea. So a good outcome would have been bad, and now a bad outcome, the fact that it's just going to pieces in Iraq, is a guarantee that everybody else in the world can rest easy for a while, at the expense of the Iraqis and the Americans who are grinding each other up. But no, I'm not worried that Iran will get invaded. They don't even have enough soldiers rounded up to take care of Iraq, and I'm waiting to see the wave of dissent from the American GIs.
Yeah, well, there's always conscription. Now, we're almost out of time here. I'm sorry, I got to cut this short here. But I got to ask you a final thing before your recommendations and predictions for the future. Is there any way, I mean, you know, June 30th isn't that far. Is there any way that we can put this off till June 30th and give these people a constitution and create a democracy there? Or should we just drop everything and get the hell out or what?
Oh, I would say our only responsibility is to the Iraqis who are unfortunate enough to put their trust in us. And if there's a sense that they cannot get amnesty from the other Iraqis, if there's a fear that there's going to be retaliation against them, then we have a responsibility to those Iraqis. Other than that, work out truce as best as possible with whatever Iraqi factions are in power in whatever cities the U.S. is around. Hope that they don't shoot at us as we withdraw. Offer them our equipment. I would say the non-lethal equipment, the lethal equipment that we have that we can't take out, we blow it up. And we leave behind as many trucks and medical equipment and supplies, non-lethal supplies, as possible in exchange for a safe exit. That is my recommendation. Now, this being my recommendation also is my prediction. I usually avoid making big predictions, but this is my prediction. That's how the United States is going to get out, whether it's after 1,000 GIs have died or 10,000, I don't know. And how many hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, I don't know. But that's what's going to happen when the United States... What I recommend it is, in fact, what's going to happen. It's the scenario the best-case scenario. There's not even a way for the UN to go in and salvage things at this point.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time today, sir. I'm sorry we're out of time. But
All right,
sure appreciate
it.
Your insight.